Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're joined by the Howe brothers today, Caleb and Ben. Caleb is at Mediaite. Ben, oh, you can find his stuff at the Daily Beast, the Atlantic, all over the place. But you know the most important, by the way, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Having us.
Having both of you. Have you figured out, by the way, how to read political books? The most important, the first thing to do when you pick up a political book, you figured this out, right?
I'm not sure, but I want to hear the advice.
So you need to look. You need to pick it up and look at the index and see if you're in it. Okay. I'm holding in my hands the paperback edition of How the Right Lost Its Mind, and if you go to the index, both of you are there and play significant roles. Ben, you're on page 15, 181, and Caleb, you are on page 78. So you play a significant role in explaining to me how the right lost its mind. And Ben, I have to tell you, I had your quote, you probably remember this, on my desk for months when I was trying to figure this out. Remember this one where you wrote, I chose peace over principle. I chose to go along with those I disagreed with on core matters because I believed we were jointly fighting for other things that were more important. I ignored my gut and my moral compass. The result is that, almost to a man, every single person I cringed at or thought twice about is now a supporter and cheerleader for Trumpism. That hasn't changed, has it?
No, I think the only thing that has changed, there was like a group that was ready to cheerlead right away in 2016. And then there were a lot of people who were hedging. I think they were seeing the same polls everyone else was. Thought Trump was probably not going to win, wanted to support the party, wanted to make sure they talked bad about Hillary, but were hedging still, like, he wasn't my first choice, you know, stuff like that. But that's turned into he's the greatest thing that's ever existed, and they protect him at all costs. And I still haven't figured out if they're doing that out of a true cultish worship of partisanship and party, or if they just can't stand the idea that they invested in so much and were wrong. It's either ego or blind devotion. I can't figure it out.
Well, it's like when you're gambling and you've lost $100, you figure, you know, if I just keep going, if I keep getting deeper and deeper into the hole, maybe I'll get it back. I don't know. So, you know, we all remember that the 2016 election was this binary choice because Hillary was the worst thing in the world. And if she was elected, we would all be like Flight 93 and crash into the Capitol building. But I just got to bounce this idea off of both of you. The Democrats, you know, I'm quoting from my own book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. I'm really getting the feeling that the left is in the process of losing its mind. And if 2016 was a binary choice, what are these swing Republican voters going to do if the Democratic Party goes along with its id to lurch as far left? So give me your take, both of you. Give me your take on Kamala Harris, who's getting rave reviews for her rollout. But she seems to be checking every single box of massive government overreach, expansion of the federal government. So give me your take, Caleb. I know you've been tweeting about this all day.
I think that checking boxes is a good way to put it. There are the two personalities of the Democratic Party right now, Pelosi and AOC, right? And so the nominees got to get the whole party together. Harris is trying to check the requisite amount of boxes from the Pelosi and AOC side to ride right up the middle of the primary. She also, by the way, I also do praise that the rollout, she made it more professional, with Gillibrand having such a terrible rollout. It awful. Looked even better. And, you know, so I think that she's made a good impression. I'm professional. I can be taken seriously. She had the CNN town hall obviously arranged before she even announced. She teased on Colbert. You know, she did the whole pop culture rollout along with the political rollout. She did it in the right places that played to her demographics out in Oakland. So I think that what she's really done smart is set herself up as, I'm the one you can vote for, whichever part of the party you're with. Right. I'm the one you're safe voting for. She checks the correct boxes. I think some things that maybe we weren't expecting are going to become the requisite. Like, you're just going to have to say Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to Medicare for All to be in the Democratic primary.
So how does that play in the general election, though? I'm trying to sort of fast forward into the question of electability, because, of course, the conventional wisdom is that any Democrat is likely to beat Donald Trump. But I'm trying to imagine a suburban swing voter who, you know, might like the idea of, nationalized medicine until they realize that it's going to be a $30 trillion tax bill. I mean, these are one of these ideas that sound great, you know, in the progressive bubble. But how are they going to play in the general election?
Because it's not going to hinge on the applicability or even how much people like a particular policy. It's all going to be about the attention span. It's going to be about what people are paying attention to and what the media is paying attention to. You know, if it's all about scandals and if you vote for Trump, you're a racist. If you're from a Starbucks, you're going to split the vote. If they focus on all the pick-a-own politics and the sort of social pariah aspects, then it doesn't matter so much if the Democratic candidate has a policy that average American might think, well, that sounds really expensive and we can't do it. First of all, they're going to think to themselves, well, Trump had stuff and he never got it done. How long did we not get the wall funding? How long did he not do the things that he promised? And he had the House and the Senate. So are the Democrat candidates even going to follow through on their more ridiculous promises? How long has it been? How long have we spent over the last 2 years talking about politicians who haven't followed through? So what's what people pay attention to, what the media pays attention to, what the focus is on. And, you know, Trump's going to have a lot to do with that, too, because he's going to try and focus on things that play to his strengths.
OK, I just think you made a great point there. You know, guys like me have, you know, the big mistake that I think we've made is to assume that these elections do turn on policies and ideas when, in fact, we're in a completely new era. You know, it is identity. It is, whatever the tribal impulse is at the moment. And as you point out, the news cycles and our attention span get smaller and smaller and smaller. What do you think, Ben?
You know, I think there's a chance, and maybe I'm overestimating the strategery of the Democrats here, because they so often seem to miscalculate Trump and what's going to work and what's not going to work. But I feel like it would be hard to miss the fact that there's two components to Trump that it's important if you want to shift the policy argument in your favor. He doesn't really have a core ideology, and his base will embrace whatever he decides he wants to do. And then they'll all do contortions to make it seem as though what he wants to do is ideologically driven, and it's brilliant, and it's really the actual conservative position. So when I look at everything that's rolling out right now from the candidates and their embrace of things that they used to be a little more subtle about, it almost seems like trial balloons. I mean, if they feel like they can push the debate farther left on, for instance, healthcare, and Trump starts to read the tea leaves that that's the mood of the public, and he starts to sort of come to where they are, he'll spin it as he always does, as this is what he was always saying, and the base will follow along with that and support what he's saying, and the Mike Huckabees and others will come out and be like, actually, Heritage came up with this years ago, you know, whatever.
He has that. He always has something to fall back on, a prior tweet or interview where he said the opposite of whatever he said in a different one.
Right.
Okay. You know, this raises the question. We have a piece up at the Bulwark by Molly Jong Fast about the civil war that's broken out between the diehard nativist, wall advocates and the usual sycophants, and lickspittles that you're discussing. So are you confident, Ben, that, I mean, is there 5% of the base that is going to peel off if he doesn't get the wall? I mean, what percent of the base is in the Ann Coulter school of actually believing he was going to do something, as opposed to, say, the Charlie Kirk, Mike Huckabee, Newt Gingrich wing, which is basically going to go along with anything the president says?
I feel like you could fit everyone that will peel off from his base in a Starbucks. I mean, I just don't. They have the amount of commitment to every single thing he does, no matter how, not just to say they excuse it, or not just to say, hey, I don't agree with everything, but to spin it as actually this was the plan all along. I mean, they do it constantly in his favor. They're emulating his narcissism in a lot of ways in order to defend him. I don't know what they think that their objectives that are going to be achieved by doing that, but they seem to believe there's some greater good that's being served by constantly spinning everything he does as a good thing, and they certainly won't vote for a Democrat. I think the only place you're going to see shifts in votes are going to be on the Democrat side, either voting for the Democrat or voting for an independent. I think the Republicans are going to go for Trump.
Okay, so Ben, you gave us the perfect segue with the Starbucks reference, Howard Schultz. The reaction among the Democrats on the left is really interesting. We talked on yesterday's podcast with David Jolly, who was really kind of high on Howard Schultz. But the Democrats seem to be in, convinced that Howard Schultz is virtually a stalking horse for Trump's reelection. So give me your take on that, Caleb, the way that Howard Schultz is playing out, and what almost feels like an attempt to sort of strangle the Howard Schultz baby in the crib.
It is. I think it's interesting, but not necessarily telling that Democrats think of him and are speaking about him as a spoiler for Democrats, and Republicans aren't thinking the same thing with Trump. That's interesting. You might think in both cases it's a reverse psychology strategy. Trump a little bit obvious about it with the he doesn't have the guts to run tweet. Obviously goading him in thinking that he's going to, you know, spoil the Democrats. Could it be the Democrats are playing a long game thinking he'll be a spoiler with moderate Republicans? They might think that. I know there are some Republicans who do think that. Roger Simon at PJ Media today has their lead story is that Schultz could actually win the presidency and that he could do it by peeling off Trump dissatisfied Republicans and also people in the middle who are looking for someone who isn't radical and doesn't make waves and rock the boat, which is the lane Schultz is trying to go in. I know Jolly said yesterday that he's not a spoiler. He's a contender. And there is an extent to which you can say that it's a little early, I think, to make that prediction. But if the question overall is, can an independent candidate really make an impact in the next election? Obviously, with the caveat that it's going to depend on attention span, I think for sure they can make an impact, even if it's only to influence what the two primary party candidates are discussing, what the debates focus on. And by the way, those will be a hilarious disaster on the Democratic side. I don't even know how they're going to fit 47 people on a stage to debate. But if the question is specifically about Schultz, it's a bit early to say if he can make waves. He might be the sacrificial lamb, the first independent candidate who gets destroyed by Oppo Research. And there's a big pile on. I mean, if you check on Twitter, if you go to media, story up right now, there's a big pile on him, especially about just the word billionaire being used repeatedly by Elizabeth Warren. And he last night, not really attacking, but citing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the reason he doesn't want to run as a Democrat. He bashed her. He bashed Harris for her embrace of Medicare for All. So he is also trying to straddle a different fence instead of the middle path and the Democrats, the middle path overall. But it's a bit early to say if he can be a real impact.
Yeah, let me try this idea out on you, see what you think about this, because, of course, you know, most of the spin in the last 48 hours has been that he would draw votes away from the Democratic nominee and help Trump get reelected. And maybe that's true. But I'm thinking of voters. And I'm realizing how atypical I am that I speak for absolutely no one. But, you know, we get to the fall of 2020 and the Democrats have nominated somebody, in the Bernie Sanders AOC, lane or the Elizabeth Warren lane where they're talking about, you know, massive. Somebody on Twitter referred to the agenda of turning America into a Soviet style hellscape, which I should actually attribute that to somebody. But that you have moderate or disaffected Republican voters who, you know, perhaps reluctantly voted for Trump because they thought it was a binary choice. Those people will definitely vote for Trump in that case, unless they have a more palatable, plausible alternative. So I could imagine many suburban business oriented Republicans who would otherwise vote for Trump as the default candidate, considering voting for Howard Schultz if he was in that race, you know, if they have two really absolutely distasteful choices. I actually can see a constituency, and it would be a constituency that would peel off votes that would otherwise go to Donald Trump.
If they think, I mean, there is a type of voter who thinks it's okay for me to vote for someone else because there's no chance he'll win and it's no chance it'll be a spoiler. There's a kind of person who will register their vote only under the concept that it won't change the outcome.
Ben. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that Schultz might be thinking, like, I've seen a lot of the polling that people talk about where they say there's 40% people identify as independent, but when they drill down on which party they lean towards, there's only 10% that don't actually lean towards one party or the other. And I think one of the things that Schultz might be thinking is if he's going to get any of those disaffected, Republican leaning independents, they may be the kinds of people that just can't bring themselves to push the button for a Democrat, but they might be able to for an independent. Maybe that's what he's counting on. But what I think is most fascinating about all of it is how similar all of the discussion is about him and how it sounds exactly like what people said about Trump, that he's going to be handing the election to someone else. He's a billionaire who's doing a vanity project, that he has no backbone in terms of what the interests of the Democrat Party are. And like the whole party seems to be unifying against the idea. And when I think back to how everything was said back in 2016, that's the only reason that looking at all this, I go, maybe he will actually make a difference because this all sounds so familiar.
Please, Ben, could you not traumatize us?
Well, he's a more polished Trump, at least.
Well, yeah, but there's a big category shift there. So you saw that new WAPO ABC poll. The percentage of voters who say they would definitely not vote for Trump next year in the general election. 56% of voters say they would definitely not vote for him. 59% of independents definitely not vote for him. Black voters, 90%. Hispanic voters, 76%. 56% of suburban voters. White non-college women, 47% say they would definitely not vote for him. And white women with college degrees, 65%. Percent say they would definitely not vote for Trump in the 2020 general election. Now, on the surface, that seems devastating. But kind of remember what the polls also look like. The polls look like before the 2016 election. Donald Trump doesn't really need to be all that popular, does he?
No. And also, I think it's important to remember that people say a whole lot of crap far enough out from the election that tends to shift. I knew a lot of people that were allegedly never Trump, during the 2016 election. And then when it got closer, it became, okay, I was hypothetically never Trump, but I'm going to vote for him. I mean, I think people, as they get closer to actually doing the deed, their party loyalties tend to come out. And most people, even in those polls, show that people who claim to be independent, they really do have a loyalty to a party. They just don't like identifying themselves that way. And the disdain that a partisan has for pushing the button for another party is just, it's hard to underestimate, but when they are being asked a year and a half before what they think, they want to sound all independent minded. I guess I'm saying, I just don't believe them.
No, I think that's a great point. I mean, it's one, you know, a lot of these polls are based on some sort of generic Democrat, and it's a referendum, you know, up or down on Trump. But would it come next November, there's going to be somebody else on that ballot.
That's Trump's biggest strength is in having people vote against someone else rather than. And that is definitely going to be the case. I think next year is what motivates people the most. There is a way of looking at a presidential election as voting for everything but the person running for office, which is who you're voting against, what you don't want people to do, and who you want to take revenge on. And all those things are definitely going to play a part for Republican voters who are going to, who are looking for somewhere else to cast their vote. And, you know, they're definitely not going to get that opportunity in the primary to any effect whatsoever. The RNC has come out. In fact, I don't know if you guys saw yesterday. I really I meant to clip this, and I just didn't get around to it. But Kaylee, pronounce her last name, Ben McEnany.
No, good luck.
Yeah, we know who you mean.
She was on. They asked her about the RNC's resolution, you know, to support Trump, and to the exclusion of any other Republican challengers. And one of the things she said I thought was really telling, she said, well, you know, we did this not just to show our support for the president, but to fight back against or to counteract the media who just insists on showing dissenting Republican voices. So the essential premise that she was getting at was, we're tired of there being platforms for Republicans who don't like Trump, and we want to make sure that they shut up.
Yeah, there's no question. So, Caleb, I want to ask you about this. I mentioned that I quoted you in the book and your analysis of conservative media. And the question that I want you to think about is whether what you described here, that I quoted you describing, has gotten worse, what the trajectory is. You were describing the business model of conservative media. The problem, obviously, is the talk radio, conservative publishing, Fox opinion show model is not about conservative policy and ideas or good government or increasing our liberty or social conservative values or even really about the Constitution. To a great extent, it is essentially about getting the audience outraged. Outrage clicks on links. Outrage tunes in. Outrage buys books. And that was the description of sort of Fox News, Limbaugh, Breitbart, Drudge, all of those. Since you wrote that, has it gotten worse? And do you see any change in the trajectory there?
Well, first of all, I'm outraged by that. That is just, No, I mean, obviously, I think if anything, that the mainstream press has embraced the same model. They're about outrage as well. In fact, I think that's going to be a major part of the 2020 election, is who you can get more outraged and what you can get them more outraged about. It'll definitely be more important than the policy that any individual candidate supports. That'll be true for the Democrats as well as for independent voters. It's going to hinge on what you're the most upset about. And that has not changed, I don't think, in the slightest. I don't know that it's increased, because you can only turn the volume up, you know, until it hits maximum. So I don't know that it's increased since then. But definitely getting people angry and outraged is the motivator that every person in the sort of online activist media turns on.
Well, this is the symbiotic relationship between Donald Trump and the conservative media, because, of course, this is his playbook. You know, that the president, what he will do is he will try to turn up the outrage. He picks targets, and, you know, he will go out there and, you know, we need to be outraged about these women who are being duct taped with blue duct tape. I don't know where the blue duct tape comes from, you know, and, you know, brought into the country. You know, it is the Mexican rapist. It is something that he will turn the focus on. So in many ways, the media model that you described has now become the model of all of our politics, that we're no longer just talking about media criticism. We're talking about the central dynamic of our politics, led by, in part, by the president, but maybe emulated by others, which is to keep that outrage machine against the other side tuned up to 10 or 11 all the time.
Right. Vote against, not for. I mean, you can see it in his Twitter just in the last few days, just since the wall negotiation broke down, just since the end of the shutdown, Trump has been back on trying to find. I wish I could remember what the tweet was last night, but he's trying to find that latest thing, that latest topic that he can change the subject to, in order to get people upset about something else. So that the voters who were disaffected by there not being a wall at the end of a month-long shutdown, have the opportunity to say, okay, well, we're disaffected, but at the same time, I'm super mad about, you know, this Gillette ad. So I guess
the Covington kids. I think people on the left and in the media, you know, have a sense, but don't fully understand how that's playing on in conservative media, how that's really become sort of the symbol of not just, you know, the media's malpractice, but also the fact that they're coming for you. They hate you. If you give them a chance, they will destroy you. They will destroy your husbands. They will destroy your church. They're coming after your kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think also, you know, on top of all of the media political outrage machine, there is this form of capitalism that's grown up out of it in the corporate world and the branding world. Because when I see things, some of these, you know, the right will call them virtue signals or whatever, but these companies that take positions, take political positions, maybe there was a time they were doing that because their corporate leaders really just had a strong desire to take a position on something. But these days, it doesn't seem like they're doing it in order to make a good point. Like, they're not hiring a controversial person in order to express some positive idea. What they're trying to do is stoke, for instance, the right into being outraged enough that they'll film themselves burning Nikes on TV. And then when they do that, the left will become loyal to the product. So in the same way that Caleb was talking about how it's about what they're against, you've got companies that are going out of their way to try to earn loyalty through stoking them being against Trump or against the right or whatever.
So you're saying that the model is they're actually doing things to trigger conservatives so that then they would.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're doing this to own the cons so that liberals will be triggered to buy our product.
I think they earn brand loyalty because it becomes brave when they do that. And you know, I've said before, like, one of the fastest ways to make money in the stock market is to wait for a company like Nike to do something that's going to outrage the right, buy their stock as it starts to go down because people get worried, wait for the Trump tweet where he yells about them, and then suddenly it'll plummet more, buy some more stock, wait a couple weeks, it'll correct, and you just made some money. I mean, I think it's growing. The outrage machine is growing.
Don't mistake that there are people that some of the people that are part of that media aren't true believers. I mean, especially on the conservative media side, at all levels, you'll hear, you know, that we know what time it is. They hate you. This is an existential.
They want you dead.
Right. So there is to a great extent those, and they'll write articles using that as the rationale. So, no, I wasn't for Trump, but the fact is it's us or them. So we're going to have to be. I mean,
that's very powerful. That is very powerful. If you can convince people that it is in fact the apocalypse, that they do hate you, that they are going to destroy you, that's highly motivating. You know, whatever the details are. So actually, listening to you, you know, perhaps there is three-dimensional chess. You know, perhaps that we need to understand that this is a great article for you guys. One of you should write this. Or one of us will steal it. The you know, three-dimensional chess of outrage politics. That's actually pretty good stuff. I feel smarter having listened to you guys. So,
that's a first for me.
Well, you know what? We should end on that note. Everybody's going, damn, that was quite an insight from the Howe brothers. Hey, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it very much. Caleb Howe and Ben Howe.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.